So welcome everybody to the 22nd of September Aries Bifold user group call. Note that this is a Linux Foundation call, so note the antitrust policy and the Hyperledger Code of Conduct. So we're all trying to be nice to each other and do good work. So just keep that in mind in our interactions. I want to start off with welcoming everybody and give an opportunity for you to say hello, who you are, what your interest is in the project, whether you're new or old. I'm happy to hear from you.
Hey, why don't I start? My name is Jason. I'm pretty new to the group. I've just joined the BC Gov team. So we're going to be looking to use Bifold for a wallet we're going to grind out over the next short while here. So glad to be here. Thanks for hosting it. Back to you.
Awesome. Thank you, Jason, and welcome. We are glad to have your contributions and support. All right, let me go ahead and I'll paste this in the chat. Feel free to add yourself to the attendees list. Announcements and work updates. I think that this is, there may be some out of date things on AFJ, but anybody want to any deployments and work updates that we should highlight?
Well, not yet really. I'm looking if it is in between, but I know that we are gonna start on some that we needed for a project notification mediator notification support.
Mediator notification.
Yeah, so it basically, I think we're also, and I'm not entirely sure, because this is Dima's thing, but I think we're also gonna implement a part in ACAPI, but it basically means to send out a notification, hey, your mediator has a message for you, which we would then, receive, but I guess that is an extensions. Package.
Is that like
an extension package to ACAPI?
Sorry?
Is it an extension package to ACAPI is what you meant?
Well, it will probably be a plugin in ACAPI. We're using this for a project for a client that uses ACAPI. So we want to send out a notification from ACAPI, basically a notification from ACAPI, the ACAPI mediator. Saying, hey, there is a message for you. And then on the receiving end, we are using React Native with AFJ. So we'll probably implement something there, and that would then be the extensions repository of AFJ. So it's a two-sided sword.
So we've had some conversations in the community about the right ways to do push notification. Have you guys been involved in those conversations?
I've been involved in one, and I think Timo has joined multiple. So
okay, the idea is that it's unlikely that we're going to come up with one protocol to rule them all. Mm-hmm. So we can, if whatever you probably have some particular platform that you're doing push notifications on, right? It'll either be iOS or Android probably, and there's a couple of third party ones that are also will do this. So you don't yet have a protocol for setting up and executing that push notification, or at least could setting up the push notification, right? But if you define one for a particular platform that other people can replicate, that would be amazing and will still give us open source compatibility with the variety of projects. You would just be responsible for supporting that particular protocol in your mediator, and then and in the mobile app, of course, and then through protocol discovery, you can figure out which push notification methods you both support, and then you would be able to use those. Does that make sense?
Yeah, exactly. That, well, yeah, the idea is to, and we'll have to see how much work that is, and probably it won't be perfect in the first draft, but to create an interface where, yeah, our client uses Azure. So we'll make an implementation for that. But yeah, the idea is that you could extend it with Firebase or whatever other services.
Right. But rather than trying to like shove everything into one protocol, I think that having one protocol per push notification method gives us both the flexibility that we need to support multiples and an easy way to discover which method, you know, what method the other side supports.
Yep, I agree. Cool.
Awesome.
And awesome. Looking forward to seeing that work.
Me too. That would be cool.
All right. Anything else here? Awesome. This is what I have prepped currently on the agenda, going over some meeting timing, some connection invitation discussions from Sam. I wanted to give space here for some SVG credential package updates, but I do not see Horatio on the call, so we will table that for future call. Wanted to talk some on App Store deployment and left a section for NPM packaging for the Aries hook hooks package, if Timo is around to talk on that. And then time for questions for the maintainers or other discussion. Is there anything, any adjustments we want to make here or things we would like to add or, yeah. Awesome. Well, let's start off then with the meeting time. We've proposed switching to Tuesday at 3 p.m. GMT, so 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern for the U.S. This is a more European-friendly time. This does conflict with the Indie Contributors call. Is there concern about moving to this? Would we like to propose a different time? Want to get the thoughts from the group.
I'm just quickly converting this to European Central to see. I have no problem with this time.
Jason, do you have any conflicts with the proposed time? And I know Stephen Curran was somewhat concerned about the Indie Contributors call. Figured I would ask what your thoughts were here.
I mean, it worked for me. I'm pretty new, but I mean, week to week's gonna be I know a little bit exciting with the calendars always changing, but seems good so far.
Sweet. Well, without any other thoughts, I think we can go ahead and move towards doing this. If there is a problem with this, just raise that in the Rocket Chat, and we'll happily discuss.
Just to verify, the ACPI call is also still bi-weekly, right? So we would be on the other end.
Correct.
All right, perfect.
And I will look to get that added to the calendar of meetings so that that will also be helpful for understanding where it is in that. Awesome. On to connection invitation discussion. Sam, take it away. You are muted, by the way.
I am muted. And can I share?
Yes.
So if you've been around in the community for about a year, you may have heard me talk about this before. And I appreciate James giving me some time to sort of evangelize this idea. I want to talk about the user experience of accepting connections and a mistake that we made. And I say we, including me, it's probably my fault. So here's our current UX flow, right? Bob creates an invitation, Alice scans it. Then we ask, we present a UX to Alice, whether we want to accept or ignore that invitation. And then if she says yes, then we do a request, a response, complete, now we're done. Right. And they have a connection. And it's the timing of presenting the UX to Alice that I think we've made a mistake on as a community. So good UX wants things like a name and an image and other stuff. And invitations have a label. This came up because, you know, people were asking like, oh, hey, can we support this image URL and the invitation thing, which I get it. People want a better user experience and images help things like that. The thing that I'm concerned about is phishing attacks. Any unverified information, particularly like an invitation, makes a trivial phishing attack because it looks like your bank, it has the same name and it has the same logo. And so it looks the same. And so that's what I'm concerned about. Right. So I think we need to, that this is also going to increase the type of information that you actually want to exchange to establish trust is going to be increasing, not decreasing over time. And so I think our mental model is flawed and I apologize. I think the solution to this particular problem is to change where in the timeline we present a UX to the user so that we can ask them a question with verified information, rather than unverified information when we're asking them to make a decision about something. And in this case, it's, you know, establishing that initial connection. The reason I'm preaching to this particular group is because you guys happen to be involved in making a mobile app, right? And I think that every concept shift needs a leader. And I'm hoping that Bifold could be that leader, right? The last time I presented this was like before Bifold was really a thing. And so, and it had been in my mind to like share this with you guys, but it hadn't come up yet. And then, James prompted me and I asked for some time. So that's why I'm preaching this. So here's what this actually looks like, right? You still do an invitation. The actual protocol work isn't really different here. And let me talk about it. You create an invitation. Alice, upon scanning it, and it immediately jumps into the request, the response, and the complete. The reason why that's useful is that Alice and Bob now have a secure communication channel over which they can communicate. That's important because now you can interact with things that will help establish identity, verify things, basis of trust, all of those things. And when I say please send basis of trust, this is not a protocol. This is a generic stand-in for whatever types of protocol things you'd actually want to do here. Right, so there's no protocol here, but this could be credential exchange. It could be, hey, I would like, other types of information from you that makes sense. And after that actually happens, Alice's agent decides, now I have enough information that I'm actually going to ask Alice if Alice wants to accept or ignore this invitation, or accept this connection. And this actually models a lot closer to what we do currently with like browsers. You first set up the connection and you send some stuff across. And then, for example, it might pop up and ask you a question, right? The annoying one of current is, hey, can I send you push notifications, right? But that's the type of interaction, but it happened after the secure connection was actually set up, not really in advance of that actually happening. And so shifting it this way, I think is a better idea because it means that the information that we're presenting can actually be valuable. Now, one of the problems is, yeah, I forget what other slides I have here. Oh, so reasons for trust, right? VCs is ideal, right? Verifying a domain using a well-known DID configuration is also something that's doable like right now. So if you're connecting to a, you know, an agent that represents whatever.com, we can use the well-known DID configuration to go to whatever.com to be able to verify that information. And then there's also, we've talked about like email ownership and sort of the proof of social media stuff. So like I can present you a proof that I am Telegram Sam on Twitter. And that way, if you happen to know me on Twitter, that's useful as a basis that we're making this happen. The other cool thing about actually formalizing how this works and shifting it later is that we solve the phishing or the man in the middle problem. We first set up a connection and there may be a man in the middle, but when we actually go and ask for these proofs, then the man in the middle is unable to provide them, which helps us to detect that this is not a good channel. So the difference here is that there's two main areas of work. One is that we need to change the flow and how agents handle new connections so that the new connection record kind of needs to be created so that you can actually communicate. But what we need to do is flag it as like a pending connection because the user has not yet accepted it. And there's a limited number of protocols that we're willing to engage the other party on. And then after the user says, yes, I want to keep this one or accept or keep or save or, you know, whatever we figure out for the UX, then we can mark it with sort of a full connection status so that we interact just like we do today. So that work is there, but it's really a workflow thing, not really a massive, there's no protocol work here. What will be then needed is what we actually work on as a trust basis to say, hey, well, like, why should I trust you? And there has been some initial work here, but because there no agent has been in a state to actually act on this, it hasn't really been pushed forward. And so I think that would be a really valuable thing to do. One of the things that you can do, of course, as soon as you actually have a connection is do feature discovery on the other side and say, hey, what are you willing to talk to me with? And that way you can discover which trust basis protocols the other side supports and actually engage in those. So that would be something that is possible to happen right there. So that's really the work that's required. So this is a slightly old deck. Do we need to wait for DIDCOM V2? We don't have to. There's a substantially different connection model in DIDCOM V2 in the sense that there's not actually a formal exchange of DIDs protocol. It actually happens alongside the connection actually happening anyway. So moving to a model like this is actually going to help us transition to DIDCOM V2 a little easier from a trust basis perspective. And the current flow that we have isn't actually going to apply anyway. So I think that it's an easy transition there. And can we move there gradually is one of the questions, or do we need to, as a community, to make it all happen? The answer, I think, to this is a little unknown. It depends on what the community wants to do. But what I do know is that there is a flow that we can offer let's say Bifold does this and no one else does. And so it's going to be connecting with agents that aren't capable of actually making this happen. That's okay. I think we can come up with a workflow that basically says, hey, this is an unverified connection. Here's the unverified label. Do you want to accept it? And that way it still is backwards compatible with the current flows that people kind of expect or the agents. And then as the trust basis type of protocols become widely supported, those will be able to engage in, and instead of asking them to accept the connection based on untrusted information, you'll actually be presenting green checkmark style trusted information for them to accept the connection on. So there isn't a need, I think, to move as a whole community block. I do think that after one agent does this and we can sort of evangelize a working example of what this is like, then I think we could, argue that as a community, we should move this direction and see what we can do. And maybe it becomes a part of an interoperability profile. The short answer is it's not going to break anything if just Bifold does this. I think that's actually a feature that Bifold has is like, hey, we're actually able to do trusted acceptance of connections rather than just the untrusted ones that everyone else does. So we're not going to like fork the universe here when we do this. So that answers that a little bit. I talked a lot because I'm trying to fast because I'm not trying to occupy a ton of meeting time. Are there any questions, thoughts, things Sam doesn't realize that he should?
I have, yeah, you made a distinction between, you said like there's a basically a subset of protocols you want to engage in before you quote unquote trust the other party. Which protocols would like which protocols are non-trusted, if that makes any sense?
Well, like they're all trusted. What I mean though is that if we put something in an invitation, like an image URL, that's untrusted information. Because it's not verified from anyone. So when I say trusted protocols, I literally mean any protocol. But because it's happening now after the connection has been set up, then now we have all the benefits of having a DIDCOM channel available to us, right? Like we can make sure the message came from the other party and stuff.
Yep.
So the obvious one that exists today is credential exchange. You know, you could, for example, fire up a credential exchange with a goal code or something that says, hey, do you have any credentials like this? And then, you know, you could respond with something that would work. We need to be a little more generic here. It would be nice, for example, if we had some sort of a message that said, hey, please send me a basis of trust. And maybe a goal code would be useful here in the sense that the goal code indicates, I would like you to tell me some reason I should trust you, but it's very open-ended. And the benefit of doing that is that the Alice doesn't have to know which things in advance Bob is going to send. And anything that Bob does send, Alice can evaluate and decide if that's something that they trust or not. For example, you could say, please send me a basis for trust. And Bob can respond back with a credential, that, you know, from a governance framework that Alice already accepts. It could be like the social media profile one, I think is a good candidate for us to actually act on earlier rather than later. But any of those are there. So the protocol that already exists is a credential exchange, right? And if you ask the other party for a credential that they like can't provide, well, they're just going to ignore it, or they're going to send back an error report, in which case you're like, okay, you can't. But I think we can optimize that with things like a message that says, hey, here's a goal I have. I would like you to present me with, you know, some useful information.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So this is where the actual protocol development is. Shifting the UX here is actually not a protocol thing. It's just a UX thing.
James has his hand up.
One of my questions / thoughts actually here is, one of the things that we are putting in the invitation is a label. I wonder if it makes more sense to pull that out, honestly. Or the connection is actually just for connecting, and then you do the label and other pieces after, right?
So I think that's the goal, James, but it's kind of the victory lap, right? If when we get to the point where people are like, hey, we're doing these like verified connections and the UX lines up really nicely, so we're asking users to accept based on verified information, why do we have a label here? Then we party because we fixed a trust problem. So you're right, but we can't really argue for that until we solve this.
Well, I guess one of my thoughts is, I don't feel like, what is the mechanism that I should send a label that is not in the invitation?
So there's two ways that I can think of. One of them is that you send like a self-attested profile. That doesn't solve the phishing issue. It's nice because it can be really rich and expansive without like really making the QR code really dense. But it's also not trusted information. And so what you send is likely going to be, credentials are the way we do trust, right? So it needs to be a credential. The problem is who from. We don't yet, this is a bit of a bootstrapping problem because we don't yet have like government and entities, for example, that will verify a business. We don't really have anyone that will actually issue a business a credential, and we don't really have anyone that will like verify me or present me with some sort of credentials that I could use. If I had a driver's license credential and zero knowledge, and we figured out the right way to do like a biometric picture that I could also present, I could do that. That's where we have the bootstrapping problem. So the first two things I think we should get started with are from the business side. I think we need a protocol that is not a credential, but it basically says, I claim to be domain X, example.com. And then you'd use the the diff standard for proving ownership of a DID on a domain with a .wellknown file to actually verify that. For a person, I think that like social media stuff is the easiest. And the easiest one to do, for example, is an email address. I could present you a credential that I control a particular email address. I might send you like six. Here's six email addresses you might know me by, and that's fine. But those types of credentials, I think we can actually stand up and run today. And then we have something to start with. And ideally, we want something better, but then it becomes an issue of like, who can issue a better credential? Not how does the whole protocol flow work? Because as soon as a new credential shows up, you could immediately use it.
I also think, though, from my point of view, that doing a self-attested presentation at least seems a little bit better than putting the label in the invitation, because that
there's actually no difference.
Well, the difference in my mind is that we're specifically saying this is self-attested, while I feel like when it's in the invitation, it's like.
So the protocol says this is untrusted. So if the mobile app developer has done a terrible job presenting the fact that this is untrusted to the user, you're right. It would be an advantage to have it be self-attested. There's another difference too, in that if you send something after the DIDCOM connection, then it's not really tamperable. And it's possible for someone, if you have an unsigned invitation, to tamper with what that label actually looks like.
But because that at least to me looks like a smoother transition to say, as a developer, all I need to know is, was this is this a self-attested or verifiable? And then I can, based off of that, well, there's more detail that we can do here, but based off of that, I can do a check mark or no check mark on whether that label is actually verifiable, if that makes sense.
I think the trust difference between self-attested and the label is really low.
Yeah.
You need a credential from a third party to really pull this off. Right. I mean, that's the trust mechanism that we have. We should leverage that.
Well, and my thought though is, in terms of actually getting people to move towards a better model, that is a mechanism to get people there, is by doing a self-attested label versus
we could. I would rather lean heavily into like the proof of social media account ownership or email. The right one to do right now is email and phone.
Yep.
Because it's something that we can write today, and we can offer up as a governance framework to say, hey, here's a party verifying these things. And I'm assuming that other parties will join that, and even maybe the bootstrap party doesn't need it anymore. But I think if we do something like that today, then that's a credential that anyone can go get. Mm-hmm. And now it works when you're connecting with other people and you have like a verified acceptance rather than an unverified acceptance.
True.
Kareem?
Yeah, this is probably a very stupid question, because that's what I'm good at, because I don't know the feature discovery protocol that well either. But you mentioned that after like the initial connection is set up, you could do feature discovery, and this is more directed at the future. I have no idea again, but isn't there a possibility that just a feature discovery that might leak more information than you want, let's say 50 years in the future? Or do we need like a subset, like what features do I want to expose if the connection isn't trusted yet, or doesn't that matter at all?
That's the issue. The feature discover, so it's called the Discover Features Protocol. There was a verb thing that Daniel Hardin was on for a little while. the idea behind this is that it allows you to disclose features to the other side. There is no requirement that you just disclose all of your features to the other side. The idea there is that if you have someone in this preliminary state where you have a DIDCOM connection, but you haven't decided to trust them in any particular way, you can limit the types of protocols you're willing to disclose to them, because you don't trust them, right? So you're not gonna say, here's all the things that I do. There's a bunch of privacy implications of doing so. The deeper question is that the types of protocols you're willing to disclose, or the features that you disclose to other parties, should probably also vary after you've accepted a connection, but based on how you classify that. For example, there may be protocols that I'm willing to expose to social contexts that I'm not willing to give to work contexts, for example. And so in the future, we'll develop that better. This is the first kind of time where it's made obvious is that you should. So the types of things that you do, so the Discover Features protocol, real quick, is really short. There's a query message where you're basically asking questions about the other party. You're saying, hey, do you support any of these things? And the disclosures message type is actually the more powerful one. And it's worth noting, you can send a disclosures message unprompted. You don't have to wait for the other party to ask you. So after you complete a connection, you might just send them a feature disclosures message, which say, hey, here's the things that I support. And among them, you can indicate protocols that you support, but you can also say things like, here's goal codes that I support. So you could say, here, I support, credential presentation, and I support the goal code of who the heck are you, right? And then that's, of course, not all you support, but for the relationship state that you have that relationship in, you're saying, here's the protocols I support. And now you're going to engage with that other party. And if you complete the goal code and you've presented to the user and the user says, okay, I accept it. I'm going to accept this connection and I'm going to classify this as a work associate or a personal friend or whatever. Then you're likely to disclose more protocols like basic message, for example, that you support with the other party. Hey, I'll actually talk basic message with you because I've classified you as a friend, right? And so you're going to disclose more of those things. Does that help?
That is a super clear answer. Thank you, Sam.
Yeah. So how I imagine this working is that you move the UX flow later to accept the connection. And then as soon as the connection's done, you fire off a Discover Features disclosures that says, hey, here's the limited amount of stuff I'm willing to interact with you. And then that includes the protocols and the goal codes and the other mechanisms necessary to then get verified information for the user themselves to actually look at.
What do you do if you get a presentation request, but you don't respond. You don't support that yet.
You mean like, you don't want to answer that type of presentation request?
Yeah, they haven't proven that they're someone trustworthy to you yet.
So there's a couple of options, and it's all in the hands of really, this is a mobile app or the user's agent developer that enables these types of options. But there's a couple of options. One is you just ignore it and throw it away. Another one is that you send them an error back. You're like, yeah, we're not this good of friends yet, right? And that could be like an error report. Another way would just be to hold on to that message and fire back to them with whatever's necessary to gain more trust. And then if that completes, then you can go back, grab that previous message and then engage on it.
So from a UX perspective then, is this, do we completely do this like in code? Do you decide what the trust basis is in code, or do you also want to offer the user to toggle? You get me, right?
I totally get what you're saying.
Yeah.
And this is, it depends on how opinionated you want your software to be. So the answer is you could decide in software that like, hey, there's a certain types of behavior, so we're just not going to allow. Or it might be that you want the user to be able to select a profile or select options about how restrictive they want to be with different things. For example, let's say in your software config, you might let them set up different groups to classify contacts under. These are companies that I talk with. These are like, these are my gaming buddies, right? Whatever. And then along with each group, you could actually check the types of protocols that you're willing to interact with them on. It might be that you offer to the user. It could be that there's some more of a bundle thing where like they sort of select a bundle or a pre-selected set of protocols that the software is recommending that you support. And then of course, one of those groups is the, I haven't really accepted you into any other group yet. It's like the none group. And for that group, here's the limited set of things that I'm willing to support. And that could be configurable. I don't know that there's a one size fits all answer there. For example, like me as a power user, like I would love to be able to go and enable or disable specific protocols. But like, if your goal is my mom, right, to support a software for my mom, you're probably going to want to smooth the corners over a little bit so that that doesn't happen. And that could be done a variety of ways. Either she just simply uses a different program than I do. Maybe there's an advanced mode that you toggle that then gives you more advanced controls about how these things happen, and then defaults kind of serve you up until that point.
Fair. Yeah. Sky's the limit. Clear.
Yeah. And obviously, we have to decide, given limited resources, what we do now. Which is why I like some of these things aren't really worth developing yet, because we're all power users. Like, no one's mom is running this, right?
So I actually argue the other way is that I think it's better to go with a default, like, you must have the social media handle, or and the result of that is you either have that or it's unchecked. It says not trustworthy, right? Because that gives us flexibility, you know.
Totally. Yeah, yeah, I think that's the right answer. I think sensible defaults is the right place to start, and then you can arrive, you know, provide some overrides if you'd like. But yeah, so to do this, you could actually do the UX flow, but then already with no protocol development. But then you're going to present everything as unverified to the user, like, hey, here's an unverified thing. Do you want to accept this? The next step would be to formalize the who the heck are you type mechanisms that we need to work on, and formalize those, and doing like social media and like domain configuration would be probably the two things that we don't have to wait for anything. We don't have to like wait for issuers to show up on the scene. We can actually just do that. And someone, we've brought it up before, like, hey, is someone in the community willing to like host a domain verifier or an email verifier? And I think the people are, which will help. And then we can take that next step in the software that says, okay, we're going to attempt to do a verified information exchange prior to you doing this. Kareem?
Yeah, very, very short. Just to verify, this doesn't require an initial state in the connection protocol, right? All right, cool.
Well, except that your agent's going to flag it in some way when it shows up. So with this new connection that you automatically accept and do the setup stuff, the setup protocols on, either connections protocol or data exchange, you're going to set a flag on there of whatever kind makes sense to your software that says, hey, the user has not actually accepted this connection yet. Yeah. So that's the only state change that kind of relates to this.
I could see that as you go from the state of done to like verified or something. I don't know.
But that would require an initial state, right? So you probably want to use the tags field or something, just because that makes it implementation specific and not so much protocol specific.
Yeah. I guess one of my thoughts here is my initial take at this also is that not using the discover features portion, like we can do this all via just presentation exchange initially, you know.
It would be nice to say like, who the heck are you? And I think I have to go dig, but I think I have a protocol written up somewhere that says, here's a goal code. And then here are the governance frameworks that I'm willing to interact with. And if one of the governance frameworks is like social media handle, whatever, right? Then that's the thing that you know. And then as soon as you have identified the governance framework that actually lines up with that, then you know, they want me to present X type of profile from any of these approved issuers, and you could just execute on that. So I think we could, I think the feature discovery is like a later thing for a more full featured. I think we can use that initial protocol that specifies a goal code and governance framework links. And then, and that would get us past all of the initial implementation of this. So, and I apologize, it's taken way longer than I was attempting to.
This is about what I expected, and it's good.
It's exciting.
I personally think it's exciting. And this may be a food for thought, or you may have a good answer here, Sam. Follow-up question I had was on, we have the concept, even in out of band, of having connectionless proofs and connectionless issuance. And I'm wondering if that's something we're steering away, especially with DidCon V2.
So DidCon V2 is the barrier, because there's no such thing as like connectionless. the problem with connectionless is that if you want to further engage with that person, you're unable to, right? Like there's just not a way to make that happen. You have to go through the trouble and the handshaking of set AMP connection. In DIDCOM V2, you're sending, there's no connection setup messages. There's no DID exchange or connections protocol in DIDCOM V2. When you send a message to the other party, well, someone has to discover the other person's DID, okay? So they can then like resolve it and then send a message. But that message you send to them carries something semantically meaningful. It could be a presentation request, and it contains enough information in the headers of the message that they accomplish all of the goals of DID exchange or the connections protocol just by receiving the message. So like immediately they're able to respond to you if not. So really what you have is a scenario where connectionless and the connectioned works the same way. You just both get to decide like how long you want the relationship to last. And you can just throw away the information at any point that you want when you're done with the connection. Or there's a polite way to say, I'm done. Like I'm not, you know, you basically, we have the concept of rotating to a new DID. This is in the connections protocol. Basically, when you say, hey, I'm going to give you a DID that's different than the information that was in the invitation, same idea. But you can actually do it any time in your relationship. So you can do it later on down the road, which means that after you've interacted with this person and you're done, you can actually rotate your DID to null, which basically indicates like, yeah, I'm about to forget all of this information and you can't talk to me anymore. I'm just telling you as a precaution, right? It's like the how to not ghost the other party protocol. So, but that's it. I think that it's an awkward thing because DIDCOM 2 isn't quite ready yet. And if you want to support connectionless now to be able to interact with the other software that already does it, you're gonna have to build that. But DIDCOM 2 is gonna do away with the need to have a connectionless or a difference between connectionless and normal.
So I guess one of my questions with connectionless as a format is that we aren't doing any kind of verifiable, we can't trust them necessarily, right? Based off of what we were just saying. It may be important to try and make sure that we guide that as we go into DIDCOM V2 of we need to do verifiable, we need to be able to trust them before we do our...
So adapting this workflow into DIDCOM V2 will be interesting because like you actually have a semantically meaningful from the message from the other user before you actually ask the user to accept anything, right? So it's a little bit different. And I think the big change is that you'll take that semantically meaningful message. You can either execute it on it immediately if everything checks out, right? Or you can like set it aside, engage with them on a protocol that establishes the necessary trust and then begin acting on it, right? So that I think is going to be the main workflow. And that's different because agents haven't really had to set aside protocol messages before. They've just executed protocol messages. They come in or they don't. And so this will be a little bit of a change of agent architecture because you'll need to sort of sideline one and to make that happen. The other way to do it is just to ignore it, send the basis, you know, establish trust and then hope the other party sends it again, which is a little bit more squirrely, but may work. There may be a way to do it where you say, hey, ask that question again. So you can take like the message ID or a little bit of information from the message, store that without storing the whole message, go through the exchange and then say, hey, ask your question again. And now I'm prepared to answer it would be a thing that could develop as well.
So yeah, because from my point of view, at least it attaching requests within the invitation seems like a model that may want further discussion of not something that we don't want to do once we do DIDCOM V2.
So the out of band message still exists in DIDCOM V2, yep. And it has the ability to attach stuff in there. So that the first time you scan it, there's already some, it's either a goal code or there's already some information that you are implying from the other person. And that's still a accepted like flow. Mm-hmm. So that I don't think that will really change very much.
I think my thought is that maybe it should.
I actually don't think, well, first of all, I hope I'm smarter in the future than I am today. But I think I don't think that's a piece that we know enough about yet to suitably improve upon. I think we have bigger trust issues than that.
Valid.
I need a t-shirt for IW that says I have trust issues.
Well, let me, or any other questions for Sam on this topic?
We don't have to talk about it today, but if I can help you in any way along this journey, please ask, right? I'm the one that recognized that we probably did this wrong and that it was probably my fault. And now it's like an established pattern in the whole community. And so if I can help you in any way do this, then I would love to be of assistance to whether it's mapping out the UX or figuring out protocol gaps that we need to make sure we solve. I would be very interested in helping with that effort. I just can't move. I don't have a mobile project of my own, right? So so I can't directly push it forward.
Awesome. I think that will be helpful as we look to do so. And thank you for sharing. With our couple of minutes left, the next thing that I had on the agenda was App Store deployment. So something that I've wanted to do for a bit is I think it would be really powerful for us to be able to place Bifold in the app stores so that you can test and utilize it within your with your other use cases and applications. And I think that would reduce the barrier to actually utilizing it and partly serving the purpose of this project. I don't actually care who hosts the app in the App Store. I'm volunteering in DCO, but wanted to gauge if this is a negative to anybody or if this is wanted to gauge what you guys are thinking.
We have had some discussions that's a long, long time ago about doing it under the Hyperledger umbrella with Rai, I guess. But yeah, sadly, Timo is not here. So, and he is the man with the answers as always. Secondly, I'd say that, and I'm not very up to date, I have to say, but I checked, there weren't a lot of tests implemented. And I'd say we want to have some tests before we deploy to the App Store, I guess. Or at least somewhat of a more robust pipeline.
Yeah, I'm happy to set up more of a pipeline. I guess my thought is that having it there and we see this is broken an XYZ way makes it could help drive more effort towards it, right? But I do think a more robust pipeline would be helpful.
Yeah, I'm also not sure how the is the test harness in any way helpful in this? Could we connect that to? I am super unfamiliar with it. I know its existence, but that's where my knowledge stops.
Right now, the test harness, I think, is, at least right now, there's the mobile back channel, which means that you can manually go through it, but there, and AFJ has its own back channel, but I don't think there's anything automated on the mobile side.
All right. The thought I have about publishing this is that if you decided as a community that anyone could publish it, of course, but it was published as like Bifold published by Indicio, then that allows anyone to publish it and no one's trying to like claim the Bifold name as a product in any way. And that means that it's still available in the App Store. And should one publisher become unwilling to update it, you could have someone else step up to the plate without confusion to do that. It wouldn't be the same you know, deployed app, meaning it's not going to automatically update, but it avoids any political issues of any one organization getting blessed to be the publisher. And it also avoids the complexities of trying to do it with a Hyperledger branding, which I think might be possible, but sounds complicated.
Not that I have any problems with it, but publishing it through Indicio sounds like there is one organization behind it, right? Or am I confusing?
Well, the point there is that it would be very obviously Hyperledger Bifold published by Indicio, which means that anyone could come along, Microsoft could come along and say, oh, well, we're going to publish a version of Bifold. And it would be Bifold published by Microsoft, which doesn't.
Okay. You mean every organization could just roll out its own version of?
Of course. And of course, you could actually just brand it and not call it Bifold at all if you wanted to. That's how this works, right? But from a community use perspective, I love the idea of having one, no matter who publishes it, but it is semi-regularly updated, you know, as stable releases are hit. So that when we, it's a huge from a demo perspective, right? So I was in a call with some Microsoft folks and saw like kind of what Microsoft runs through with their demos. They are not like standards compliant in the sense that we are trying to be at all, but they have a really slick demo, right? And I would love to be able to give them a demo and say, okay, go to your app store and install Bifold. And they can say, oh, is one published by whatever? And you're like, yeah, you can either pick either of them or maybe there's just one and you pick that one, whatever. And then you can actually run through the demo. And that would be amazing to attracting businesses that want to see a live demo if they could do it on their own phone, right? And that's one of the reasons I think this would be useful for the community to actually have something in the App Store, because then it would be as close as possible to like just what's in the repository, but still demoable. And I think that having both open source and I can see it work on my phone right now is just a super power play.
Yep, I completely agree with that. My only worry in that is, and I don't know if we can legally make sure that doesn't happen, is like for me as a starting developer in Aries or whatever, it would be quite confusing if we have six bifolds which on the App Store, which are all different forks and they all do their own thing. Like I guess we cannot protect the name Bifold, so that's an issue there, but there, like, it would be nice to sort of have a signal like, hey, this is like the last release of the thing you can see on GitHub, and like the real Hyperledger. That was why I was thinking Hyperledger might be the best in that sense, but I agree with you. Hyperledger also has some political issues there, but if we have like six apps that are all called Bifold released by another developer, I guess that would be a bit confusing there.
So it's possible for someone to be a bad actor here. I think that everyone here present just like wants stuff. And most of us probably wants this to happen, but doesn't really care who does it, right? I'm in that camp, right?
I agree.
And so what I think would help is if the working group decides on kind of a policy for publishing it in the App Store. And that includes things like, hey, if you want to like white label it and call it something totally different, like go for it. Right. But it's a like there is a hope that the community maintains at least one release or like one published app in the store, so that like it's available for use and is kept reasonably up to date with what's actually in the repositories. For example, that would be, I think, a nice thing to do. And doing the name thing means that you can distinguish between them and you're not going to get in trouble by Apple because someone already has the name or something. And you could still publish the thing. So I think if the working group established guidelines for how this should work, then I think it's unlikely to be a problem, at least in the next while. And if it does become a problem, certainly all well-behaving members of the working group can take down other ones should it be a problem, right? For example, if Indicio starts, but then becomes unable to do it in the future and someone else steps up to have a published version, then Indicio can like take theirs down out of the store so that like people don't errantly install an old version and stuff like that. So that was the thought that I had there.
I could also talk to Ryan and see how, see if there's possibility there, or if this is fairly involved as we're assuming it would be.
That'd be worth knowing.
Hey, it's Jason. I'm curious, would people actually publish the Bifold wallet with that name to the store? Like in BC, we'd probably use it as a white labeled app and just, you know, reskin it and rename it and put it in there. And if you were doing a demo app, wouldn't you kind of do the same rather than, you know, I wouldn't create another, you know, photo sharing app and call it Instagram. Of course, I'd get sued, but you can see how I would cause confusion. I'd probably call it like, you know, anyways, probably.
So the expectation is that anyone who uses Bifold is going to white label it to whatever their purposes is. So all production, air quoted, copies would be named and branded something. So those aren't going to be confused with like Bifold because they've already got a brand on it, right? The reason to publish it, at least approximately under the name Bifold, is that it would be helpful to help people get there from the open source project and know that this is like, hey, this is what's actually in the GitHub repo, but running. I think, and I'm open to better ideas there, right? And it's possible that we just have to come up with some totally white labeled thing and then publish that doesn't use the name Bifold at all, but that has its own brand of confusion as to what it actually is.
I think one of the really cool things is like, if as a developer, I could just contribute to the repo and then like actually see that get put into a release and actually get just released to the App Store, and I can use it that way. Even if I don't have like, if me just as a developer, I'm contributing to this project, I don't have a company that I'm doing a white label solution with, that is a path that seems kind of cool to be able to do, if that makes sense.
I love that. As an individual contributor, being able to like contribute a bug fix or a new feature accepted by the community and then land in the App Store, because publishing to the, making an app is not super hard. Getting it listed in the App Store is painful, man. Like it's various amounts of pains depending on whether you're talking to iOS or Android, but it's still pain. And so I think that would be a really nice feature of the community if someone is willing to actually do the legwork to make the build and the publish regularly happen.
Because like, I guess one thing that I look at is that if I'm going to like say, how do I test an application using a mobile device? My brain thinks, okay, I'm going to use a Trinsic wallet. I'm going to use maybe a Lissy wallet. I think having something that's just from the open source is powerful. We're a little bit over time, so apologies, but I think the outcome here is that we got a general thumbs up, but I will talk to Rye first and maybe we can have a little bit more conversation after I do so. So
I think it might be worth drafting a thing in the working group too about the you know, group guidelines around doing this. Like, for example, like no attempt to get people to install this one instead of any other one.
Yeah.
Outside of a demo sense, right? A demo or an experimentation. Like this is not a market competitor in that way, right?
Yep.
I think it also focuses though the work of the group in producing an actual app, not just like another library that you could use to create an app, but an actual app, which is I think we actually need as an ecosystem, as an actual open source mobile app.
Yep. Awesome. Well, thank you everybody for discussion. We're definitely out of time today, but some very good discussion. Thank you for participating and being here. We'll call it here and we will talk later. Thanks everybody.
Thank you, James, and all others. Cheers.